Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It on WNYC. Welcome to the week. I'm Allison Stewart. I'm so glad you're joining me today. When the filmmakers behind the documentary Get Me Roger Stone first started following the political operative 5 years ago, Stone was kind of on the fringes of the political world, not center stage. He had been a longtime advisor and lobbyist to prominent Republicans. Stone had worked closely with Reagan, both Bushes, and even had a minor role in Watergate, but he was not really the go-to guy anymore. Then there was a man named Donald Trump, who Stone says he identified early on as having presidential potential. The doc was released in 2017 to great fascination, and now it's having an encore round of applause following the recent indictment of Stone on charges of obstruction, witness tampering, and making false statements to the House Intelligence Committee. In the film, he is called a, quote, sinister Forrest Gump by the New Yorker's Jeffrey Toobin. Yet Roger Stone clearly revels in the opportunity to relive his work as a notorious political operative. Let's take a listen.
My name is Roger Stone, and I'm an agent provocateur. Stone's rules are things that I have learned in life that I seek to pass on to others who may want to be in the same business that I'm in, or actually any business, because they're fully applicable. So, for example, a Stone's rule. It is better to be infamous than never be famous at all. Stone's rule.
Daniel DeMauro, Dylan Bank, and Morgan Peckme were there to capture Stone's role in one of the most significant events in modern political history, the election of Donald Trump. You can watch Get Me Roger Stone on Netflix now, and Daniel, Dylan, and Morgan are in studio. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thanks for having us.
So we all know the reason, aside from the film being very good, that it is trending back on Netflix, the indictments. What was your reaction, each of you, when you first heard about the indictments? Morgan?
Well, I was surprised only because Roger seemed to have put things that appeared to be incriminating in writing. And given the fact that he is an expert in the history of American cover-ups in politics, you would think that he would have not written anything down that could potentially be incriminating. But Roger had foreseen for some time, or at least predicted, that he would be indicted. So we were kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop.
How about you, Dylan? What did you think when you heard it?
Well, it was a very similar thing. For someone from the Nixon era, you would expect Roger to be exchanging information in a dark parking lot lit only by the end of an orange-glowed cigarette. And yeah, he just seemed to have really put his foot in his mouth here. And part of the problem that really struck me is that Roger, and it seems like a lot of the people like Manafort and Trump, are kind of doing their same old thing. Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, obfuscating to anyone who challenges them and threatening people. But the circumstances have changed. The FBI mm-hmm. are now carefully looking into it. And that seems to be what happened.
I'll let you weigh in, Dan. What do you think?
It wasn't surprising at all. I think everyone paying attention knew that Mueller was kind of giving Roger the full anal probe and looking into every facet of his life. And we were not surprised, just surprised that he was so sloppy.
So the film ends with the WikiLeaks scandal. That's where we leave it. Did you have a sense of just how serious Stone's involvement, alleged involvement, was with WikiLeaks when you were filming?
Well, Roger had spoken to us in the summer of 16 mm-hmm. about his desire to meet in person with Julian Assange. We had actually discussed internally the logistics of going to film him in London at the Ecuadorian embassy. As far as we know, that never panned out. And we were under the impression that there was no such meeting, because at the time, Julian Assange wasn't radioactive as he came to be as the Russia probe expanded, and that Roger had a vested interest in wanting us to capture that, because at the time he was trying to demonstrate his ongoing relevance to the campaign. And so, he had no incentive to keep that meeting secret.
The word relevance, that seems very important to him and how he views himself. Did he understand that he had become somewhat irrelevant?
Well, I'm not sure if he was irrelevant.
I mean, 5 years ago when you first started with him.
Oh, Roger was aware that he had become kind of a relic of history at that point. I think that he understood that that was one of his reasons for welcoming us into his life as documentarians, because he thought that this would attest to his importance from a historical standpoint. Mm-hmm. That being said, he was very relevant throughout the campaign, whether he was in the day-to-day mechanics of the campaign. I think what we demonstrate very compellingly in our film is that Roger is kind of the philosophical progenitor of the Trump worldview as demonstrated through his politics. And one of the through lines of our film are these rules of politics and life that govern Roger's perspective. And we show very, I think, compellingly that those are also applicable to Trump. And in fact, Trump learned them from Roger as his closest political advisor over the 29 years that Roger spent trying to put Trump in the White House.
It's interesting. When I saw the rules, it reminds me of when people talk about themselves in the third person. You know?
Well, he did work for Bob Dole, and Bob Dole did that.
Bob Dole does do that. Dylan continuously says through the documentary, I did all these certain things, but it was not illegal. Nothing was ever illegal, technically illegal. Why do you think he may have crossed the line?
Well, according to Roger, he did not cross the line. Roger calls it all a witch hunt. And one of the things that Roger and Trump does is that they vilify the other side so badly that no matter what transgression they do, even if it's borderline illegal or illegal or what many people would call amoral, they say, well, the other side has sex slaves in a pizza parlor. So no matter what I do, it's okay. And so in their own mind and to their own base, they justify it like that.
Interesting. So the judge in Roger's case is considering putting a gag order out against him, which Roger has called a, quote, legal lynching. Daniel, do you think Roger will be able to resist the media?
Well, one of Stone's rules is it's better to be infamous than never be famous at all. Another rule is never turn down an opportunity to have sex or be on television. So I think it flies completely in the face of his entire worldview that he just wants as much publicity for himself as possible. With that said, who knows if they will put the gag order on? I guess we'll just have to wait and see. And then, you know, if he continues to kind of inflame the Mueller investigation.
I would just like to point out, though, when Roger a few years ago, or I believe it was a year and a half ago, was successfully sued for defamation by a Chinese billionaire, one of the things he had to do was go on InfoWars and take his conspiracy theory back. So if that's an indication about how Roger will act when he is legally obliged to do something or pay a large amount of money, that might be an indication of how he'll act here. I defy you to find another time where someone took a conspiracy theory back on InfoWars.
My guests are Dan, Dylan, and Morgan. They are the directors of Get Me Roger Stone. So you guys really got to watch him over the period of 5 years. I'm curious about how you think he is going to react in the next year. I know this is all speculative, but based on how his temperament and what you've witnessed, how do you think he's going to behave under the indictments?
Well, one of the things that Roger says in our film is that he has this Stephen Colbert type personality, the one or persona, like Stephen Colbert had on the Colbert Report. And I think that there is a public face versus the private face. Publicly, he's basking in all the attention. He's playing it to the hilt. He's selling books based upon it, and he's trying to get as much media attention as he can, and portraying himself as someone who's being persecuted by the deep state. I think privately, Roger is feeling very differently about it. I think it's true how financially onerous this has been upon him, that it's zeroed out his bank accounts, that it's really put his back against the wall. Roger has meticulously avoided being indicted throughout his long and storied career. He's 66 years old. He certainly does not want to go to prison. And I'm sure that this is placing enormous strain upon himself and his family. So while he's projecting a brave face to the public, that is one that is in harsh relief with what he's experiencing as a person behind closed doors.
So, Dylan, this is just I wondered, the home we see him in, you see him in a home and he's got his little dog and his mom lives there. Is that the home they raided?
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
Is there anything else in the film that if I go back and watch it again now stands out to you based on the indictments? The way, you know, that's where you're like, oh my God, that's the house they went into and the, you know, the dawn. Is there anything else from the film that we should watch? If we watch it again, we should look out for?
Well, I'm not sure specifically with the raid and with things like that, but just the environment that Roger surrounds himself in says so much about him. Like if you notice in our film, his office is also a Nixon propaganda museum. Mm-hmm. And it's everything from pro-Nixon propaganda to anti-Nixon propaganda to ironic Nixon bongs. And that's just the environment Roger surrounds himself in just to keep himself inspired and to keep mm-hmm. that attitude driving at all times.
You know, there's thanks to the magic of social media and the internet, we can see so many people around the world engaging with our film, and people have noticed details that we didn't even realize. So Roger was giving a speech at a Republican club here in Manhattan that we filmed, but someone spotted in the audience Carter Page watching at a time when Ooh. Roger and Carter Page had said they had never interacted, and then they kind of had to account for that meeting, but we were completely unaware at the time. But there he is. If you freeze frame, you can see Carter Page watching with rapt attention as Roger gives the speech lambasting the Clintons.
The magic of 4K.
Oh, the internet. It will get you every time. So let's go back to the origins of the film. What were you all three doing before you started working on this film, and how did you get together? You want to take that down?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, we're all filmmakers. We kind of stumbled upon Roger as Morgan was working in New York politics and actually organized a panel and didn't know who Roger was, but just saw that he had this kind of quality where all the eyes in the room were on him. And Morgan became fascinated with him, found this New Yorker profile that Jeffrey Toobin wrote. Which really just lays out how he is the sinister Forrest Gump of American politics. His career, he's a progenitor of the whole super PAC system. He really was a key player in the explosion of the lobbying class in Washington. And we just thought like his story would be a great lens to kind of tell the history of American politics over the last few decades. We also learned from his profile that he's a very open, charismatic, and crazy character. He's a pot-smoking, bodybuilding dandy with a tattoo of Richard Nixon on his back. And he doesn't shy away from the spotlight. So we made a pitch to him like, hey, will you let a bunch of liberals make a film about you? And I think he was at a time in his life where he wanted to do that. I'm not sure he would let liberals make a film about him today.
That's interesting. He refers to you regularly in the film as I've got this liberal crew following me around. Did you ever discuss politics with him that just as people, you know, you go on shoots with people, you're around them a long time, sometimes producers and subjects, they'll get to conversation. Did you discuss politics with him?
Oh, I mean, extensively. I mean, we interviewed Roger on camera about 65 times and we spent hours with him off camera as well. I mean, we did 110 interviews with different subjects for the film. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, we know Roger better than our close friends because you don't scrutinize right. the people around you on such a granular level. And, you know, it's interesting because Roger is so, I may be hypocritical, but at least so fluid with his politics. So when we were at the Republican National Convention with him in Cleveland, you know, there would be one moment where he would be like, you know, he would diss the cops and he would be like, I can't say it on WNYC, but and then at the next moment he would see the protesters and he's like, I hope the cops beat them up, you know. So he's like playing both sides. And because he has this libertarian bent and he's pro-LGBT rights and he's pro-legalization of marijuana, and there's a lot of things that even people across the aisle from him can see a commonality with. Mm-hmm. And that's also why he's been able to cultivate such an easy relationship with the media and left-wing figures over the years, because his worldview or the way that he can speak about politics doesn't make it immediately hostile to the other side. He knows how to find the commonalities. And so, you know, Roger is a fantastic raconteur. You can't help but laugh at his jokes. He's very well read. So, you know, we had many deeper conversations about politics with him, but there is this schizophrenic side of him where he would turn around and say something that was utterly contradictory unabashedly.
Dylan, what subject for him, you know, you said obviously he likes to talk and he likes to tell stories, but what subject for him is the sore spot, the center of the bruise that when you touch it, he recoils or flinches on?
Oh, a very easy answer to that one, his sex scandal. He really doesn't like talking about that. Whenever we ask him about his swingers life or any details into the scandal that got him kicked out of Bob Dole's God and Country campaign, when it was outed for those of your audience who don't know what I'm talking about, he was the top person in Bob Dole's campaign in the 90s, which was running against Bill Clinton, as you know, the God and Country campaign. And he was outed being a swinger with his wife, advertising for young men or young couples, no fatties. And whenever we would bring that up or ask him about the details, he'd say, oh, just go rent a porno. And it was something that... he had finally been called out on, basically. He had been leading a double life in politics, and it really changed the whole course of his future when that happened.
And I think that has to do with him desiring less to protect himself, but to protect his wife's confidentiality. Roger has a really a tight relationship with Nydia, and I think that he doesn't want to rehash that because he doesn't want to drag her through the muck as a result of his own scandal. And interestingly, Roger was exposed right after one of the top Clinton operatives had been exposed for this prostitute toe-sucking scandal, if you remember that. And so this was
in the 90s.
Yes. So Roger actually was the victim of a dirty trick as a kind of a comeuppance for, to blur the scandal that the Clinton campaign was going through. Then that's why there was this going after someone in the Dole campaign.
Roger had been living in a glass house, throwing stones for decades. He couldn't have been surprised when someone threw one back.
Yeah, the karmic boomerang swung around and smacked him in the head. We're talking to Daniel DeMuro, Dylan Bank, and Morgan Pekmay about their film Get Me Roger Stone. We'll continue the conversation after a quick break. This is All of It. We're discussing the film Get Me Roger Stone, which is now available on Netflix. My guests are director Daniel DeMuro, Dylan Bank, and Morgan Pekmay. How did Stone start his career, Dan?
Well, you know, he was a political prodigy. He recounts in our film how he pulled his first dirty trick when he was just in third grade, when they had a mock election of Nixon versus Kennedy for the 1960 election. He went around the cafeteria telling all the kids that Nixon wanted to impose having school on Saturdays. He wasn't a conservative ideologue at that point. He supported Kennedy because he had better hair. So he got all the kids to believe that Nixon was imposing school on Saturdays, and JFK won in a landslide. Then when he was 12, a neighbor gave him Barry Goldwater's book, Conscience of a Conservative, and he said he just became a zealot and attended his first Republican National Convention when he was 12 years old. Went on to Washington, was already working in campaigns when he was a student at George Washington University, and actually dropped out of college and was kind of plucked by the Nixon re-election campaign in 72, and was the youngest person wrapped up in the Watergate scandal at the age of 19.
And how is that? How is he wrapped up in Watergate? It's a weird story.
it's a classic dirty trick. Roger was sent to give a fake donation to the competitor in the name of the Young Socialist Alliance, so it would look as if the socialists were supporting them. And that was what he ultimately was on trial for. And Roger completely knocks it now, calling it like a stupid, ineffective, dirty trick. But that right from the beginning was what Roger was doing.
How can we talk about Roger Stone as a trickster and an infamous guy and sort of a dandy and fun? Why are we just calling him a liar?
He's both. Right. And I think that you can't get too wrapped up in this flamboyant personality or a persona that he has. I think that, you know, we're careful. One of the reasons that we had Roger be the narrator of his own story was a very conscious creative decision, which was that the worst things that are said about Roger in our film are things that he says about himself. So they are undeniable and incontrovertible. And although Roger is oftentimes the shiny object, that can't distract us from this extremely negative effect that he has had on our politics, and not in a partisan way. So, I mean, Roger is so culpable for the explosion of unlimited money in our politics. He is culpable for the spreading of the swamp in Washington because Black Manafort and Stone was the very first company, the consulting company, that combined lobbying with campaign consulting. So you would elect people and then you would turn around and you would profit lobbying them. So this isn't something that is necessary. His toxicity is not just something that was Democrats versus Republicans, but it is something that debased our political system fundamentally. And I hope that we drive that point home in our film. And, you know, all of us, I think, in the media and as filmmakers, we always struggle to engage people in politics. It's easier now. But one of the reasons that we locked in on Roger as a subject is because we thought that people, because he's such a dynamic and bizarre and eccentric person, that even people had no interest in politics would be interested in watching a movie about him. And so it wouldn't seem like homework when we take you into the destruction, like Buckley v. Vallejo, the Supreme Court decisions that, you know, where that opened the floodgates for money in politics, but that you would, through his lens, be receptive to getting all this information that's actually really important for us to understand as Americans.
The next question may sound shallow, but I think it's not. His look is distracting, or I guess, or attractive. You know, he dresses in these crazy suits. I don't know what's going on with the hair. The hairline changes, the color changes. Dylan, as you know, as filmmakers, and I worked on TV for a long time, you're looking for the great-looking shot, and I could see setting him up was a great shot. What do you think the outer appearance is about?
Stone's rule: life is a show, be in costume. Roger specifically dresses up to make himself this larger-than-life, near-cartoonish character, specifically to be the shiny object, to get the attention. And that's one of the ways that he and Trump both do the same thing, to not only distract people from what he's saying, because he's doing it in a flashy, kind of tacky, entertaining way, but also to just distinguish yourself, to go into, even when Roger was at his lowest point, swinging elections in a small room for the Libertarian Party in New York, he'd be wearing a $7,000 suit. And that's just his image, that's his character. And he's gone through many stages. He calls this new look his silver fox.
Okay. He's naming his looks and he's got rules. It's third person. It's coming next. So Dan, a big part of the film is the idea that he identified Donald Trump early on as someone who could be, I'm going to say, like an arrow in his quiver. So somebody that he could maybe use, or somebody that he could be, he says he identifies as being presidential. What was it about Donald Trump, and what was it about their alliance, you think, that was particularly effective?
Well, I think that Roger kind of saw this outsider businessman image that a presidential candidate could be successful at projecting. You know, he's seen throughout the years with Nixon and Reagan this kind of like anti-elitist rhetoric that they use, and they're kind of like the outsiders, even though they may actually be insiders. He thought Trump could use this outsider image and say he has business acumen, like a businessman needs to be in the White House running the country like a successful business, and there's no one who's a more successful businessman than Trump, whether or not that may be true. So I think he kind of latched on to that idea. He put it in Trump's ear since the mid-80s. And, you know, as Paul Manafort says in our film, like, Roger is the first person to tell Trump, you should run for president. And that's what had him start thinking about it all the way back in the 80s.
What did you learn about American politics making this film?
I think that all of us learned through this last election that the safeguards that we thought were in place to protect the republic had been torn down, and we didn't even realize it. And what we learned was how integral Roger was to eroding those protections about allowing unlimited money into our politics, allowing the corruption of any type of semblance of morality by accentuating the power of direct connection with the public through social media. I mean, even though Roger in his 60s, Roger is a very skilled user of social media, much like Trump. Roger also was on the vanguard of the alt-right and identified a whole group of Americans that wasn't being accessed by any other media outlet and yet had extraordinary electoral potency. I think particularly on the coasts, we had a blind spot to how the country had changed about the anger in the country that Roger is so effective at honing. And so, you know, and I think we saw it when we were at the RNC in Cleveland and when we were when Dan and Dylan were in Dallas with Roger for the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. That's actually when Roger first met Alex Jones. But I think that we saw that America had transformed as a country, or was going in a different direction than most people, particularly in the media and on the coast, understood that it was going. And I hope that our film is valuable for trying to mitigate against that blind spot moving forward, and that we understand that we can close our ears to people that we don't like, you know, that, oh, I don't want to hear what Roger Stone has to say. I don't want to hear what Alex Jones has to say. Well, you have to, because tens of millions of Americans are listening to them and hanging on to their every word, and they are moving the country in a very profound way and have done so for a long time, particularly Roger.
And another important thing that we all learned is another Stone's rule: hate is a more powerful motivator than love. Roger was leading the lock her up calls and many of the, as I mentioned before, the pizza parlor sex scandal mm-hmm. type things. And it's really hard to deny that he's right, looking at the state of politics right now.
The name of the film is Get Me, Roger Stone. It's available on Netflix. Daniel DiMario, Dylan Bank, and Morgan Peckmay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you so much.